At Audi Columbus, luxury meets convenience. Family-owned since 1897, we've built our reputation on trust, transparency, and innovation. Browse our selection online and complete your purchase from home. Then, simply stop by to pick up your keys.
Drive home a new 2025 Audi A3 for $419 for 36 months with $3,685 down.
The next generation shops online. Experience the future with us at AudiColumbus.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 6/25.
In state and local government, tech upgrades aren't optional. They're essential. Whether it's improving digital services, protecting public data, or modernizing outdated systems, the demand for skilled IT professionals has never been higher. CBT Nuggets helps you stay ahead with affordable, on-demand IT training that's built for your schedule. Our short, practical videos and hands-on virtual labs make it easy to build real-world skills in networking, cybersecurity, cloud technologies, and more. You don't need expensive hardware or complicated setups, just a browser and the motivation to grow. Whether you're an IT admin, public service tech, or new to the field, CBT Nuggets gives you the tools to better support your team and your community. And with new content added regularly, there's always something relevant to learn. Join thousands of learners who are upgrading their skills and advancing their careers. Start your 7-day free trial today at cbtnuggets.com. Because smarter tech skills don't just help you, they help your whole community succeed.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the mind.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek. I am joined, as always, by my friend and comrade, Danny Bessner. And we are very pleased to welcome back to the program, Joshua Craze. Joshua is a writer and researcher. He specializes in Sudan and South Sudan. He is here today mostly to talk about the latter, although we will undoubtedly have to get into a bit of the former to understand what's happening. But Joshua, thank you so much for coming back to the program.
Pleasure. Happy to be back home.
So South Sudan has been in the news a bit lately, probably not as much as it should be here in the West or here in the U.S., but we've seen reports of fighting between factions there, the peace process, the 2018 peace deal breaking down. Most recently, the last couple of days, it's been in the news because the Trump administration is apparently trying to traffic migrants to South Sudan, lucky for everybody concerned. But basically, we want to understand what's been going on. So let's go very basic here. Take us back to the emergence of the factions that are still battling it out in South Sudan, or increasingly seem to be battling it out once again. The factions that emerged during the Sudanese Civil War, from within the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or Sudan People's Liberation Army, if you prefer, the key figures, their grievances, and what happens, you know, how they emerge in 2011 when South Sudan becomes an independent state.
Sure. Thanks, Derek. So during the Second Sudanese Civil War, which begins in 1983, it really pits a regime in Khartoum in the north of Sudan, which has been operating as a centralized predatory state, exploiting the peripheries, against a series of southern actors led by this very, very charismatic guy called John Garang, who has a PhD from America. And he sort of molds together a series of different forces from around the country. Some of those forces are from the Dinka, which is the largest ethnic group in South Sudan. Some are from the Nuer. And these forces fight a 22-year-long resistance against the regime in Khartoum. But that already is too simplistic, because it gives you the idea that there's one insurgency fighting against an army. And in reality, what happens is that the government in Sudan outsourced its war to largely newer groups inside the South. So rather than fighting itself, and we see this again today in the Sudanese Civil War, we could come back to it, it decided to fight a counterinsurgency on the cheap by instrumentalizing ethnic differences inside South Sudan and using those forces to control the oil fields and to attack the SPLM. And that war really drove itself, with foreign backing on both sides, into a position of total standoff. And really the only thing that came in the early 2000s to transform that were the Americans, a series of other external actors, for whom this was going to be a low-hanging fruit. We could get South Sudanese independence. But it's important to say that for the most of the SPLM, the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement, independence wasn't the goal. The goal was to radically transform the regime in Khartoum, in the capital of Sudan, so that it wasn't based on this predatory center-periphery relationship. But that was too much of an ask for the diplomatic community. So instead, they offered the lower-hanging fruit in 2005 of an independent South Sudan. So the peace agreement that was signed offered the South Sudanese a referendum, and it kicked all the other issues in Sudan, you know, the struggles in South Kordofan, in Blue Nile, in Darfur, into the long grass. First, so 2005, Juba, now the capital of South Sudan, where these deportees from all over the world are currently being received, becomes this like, center of a bonanza of oil interests, consultants, diplomats. This is going to be the feel-good story of the 2000s. America's really into this because otherwise they might have to talk about Afghanistan and Iraq, and we don't want to do that. So let's talk about South Sudan. Money flows in, and this basically class of people who became warlords during the Second Civil War in the SPLM are still warlords, but now they're warlords in control of the state. And what's changed about that? Well, during the war, they exploited humanitarian resources. They sort of put themselves at the top of society by creating armies, by creating the same sorts of predatory logics that define their opponents in Khartoum. And now in 2005, they have new inputs. Rather than having to divert humanitarian resources or steal cattle or displace people, which they continue to do, instead they have donor funds and oil revenues. And you really have this economy which is entirely centered in Juba. And in the rest of the country, seeing very little gains from this process. And what instead you have is you have a huge number of different factions that were previously fighting for the Sudanese government who now need to be paid off. So in the agreement signed in 2005, it's Garang, the head of the SPLM, who shortly after signing dies and is replaced by the current South Sudanese president, Salva Kiir. They're both from the Dinka ethnic group. And then you have on the outside people like Gulina Matip, this huge number of militias, largely Nuer, who have nothing to do with the peace agreement. And Salva looks at them and thinks, shit, like, they might be used as spoilers by the North to prevent us having a referendum. They might be used to attack our country. What do we do? Well, we're flush with oil revenues. The North has taken the hit and has far less oil revenues. So instead, we're going to buy them off. And so within the SPLA, which is the army, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, it integrates all of these militia forces and effectively becomes this sort of army for hire in which all the soldiers are loyal only to their commanders. And they repeatedly rebel because rebellion becomes a useful political strategy. If you rebel, then you threaten the compact in Juba. And so Juba is forced to buy you off yet again, offering you better ranks or more money. So what you really have is this emergent sort of system of a violent political marketplace in which commanders are constantly being bought back into the fold, which requires more and more money being sent on the security sector. So by the time of South Sudanese independence, it's something up to like 70% of the South Sudanese government budget is being sent buying off these figures. So already at 2011, you can think, this system at some level is unsustainable because there's a constant growth market and they constantly have to spend more and more money buying off these commanders. And then there's the unfinished question of the relationship with the North. And a lot of the central figures inside the SPLM, who are now all in opposition, mainly in Nairobi, are still loyal to the dream that we might actually have a genuine socialist revolution and take power in the North. And this comes down in 2012, shortly after South Sudan massively votes for independence because they don't want anything to do with the oppressor in the North. Shortly after that, they turn off the oil flows in a dispute over oil transit fees because the two oil pipelines, which supply like 90% of South Sudanese government income, both flow into Northern Sudan. And Northern Sudan wanted a cut from there. They wanted too big a cut. So instead, the South Sudanese go, no, absolutely not. They cut the pipelines off. They say, we'll wait you out. We have like enough financial capital that will hurt you more than it will hurt us. And they launch a raid inside Sudan. This engenders something of a crisis within the patrimonial system because suddenly all the funds are gone. And what begins is a sort of competition inside South Sudan for control of the state. And Salva Kiir realizes this is really an opportunity. Up to this point, he's had to contend with a variety of different forces inside the SPLM. We'd have to go into all of them, but we can name a couple. One is Riek Machar, who's his vice president. And Riek was part of the SPLM. He's like the leading NUA politician. He's a PhD from the University of Bradford. Many people think that he's the embodiment in some ways of the prophecies of a NUA prophet from the early 20th century. And he, during the Second Civil War in the 1990s, led a split, a rebel faction that was reunited into the SPLM, but the wound never really healed. And the wound was at some level ethnic. There is a power struggle here, but it also has an ethnic dimension. That's one of the forces that Salva Kiir, the president, thinks, I can get rid of this guy in a power struggle. And the other force, of course, are all of these newer militias that he's integrated into the state. That was the cost of getting South Sudanese independence, but that now are a threat to his rule. So he invents a coup plot. And in 2013, just 2 years after independence, the country heads into civil war. And that civil war initially takes the form really of a sort of palace coup by Salva Kiir to consolidate power inside Juba. And because the army has become so mercenary, what Salva and his other Dinka commanders have done is basically recruit forces. These forces are called the Matengan Yor, outside the army. And I'm mentioning this because we're going to see this happening more and more. So he recruits mono-ethnic militias. And in December 2013, January 2014, they go house to house, killing NUA all around Juba. It's killing NUA civilians. And this sets a touch paper to the rest of the country. The army disaggregates. All those forces that Salva had brought into the army now become the opposition. All these forces that fought against the SPLM during the war, all the NUA forces. Riek Machar is forced to run out of the capital. He goes into Jonglei, and the war begins. And the problem with the way I've described the war, it's also the problem with the way people think about the conflict at the moment, because it sounds like the conflict is between two parties, right? It sounds like it's between the SPLM under Salva Kiir with all of that oil revenue, with the backing of Uganda, which we'll come to, and on the other hand, Riek Machar and all of these newer militias. There's two sides to it. But it's unfortunately not like that. It's much more complicated, which is to say that South Sudan is a country which has 64 ethnic groups. And it's never been a country with much of a national compact. There was the national compact of struggling against Khartoum, but very little in terms of what the country was for, right? There was an against itself, but not a for itself, you know, to really distend Hegel. There was no sense of like what actually composed the logic of the country. And so when the war began, what began was a series of different struggles around the country between different ethnic groups, between different politicians vying for position. And it was useful for those politicians, ultimately, to join one of the two sides, but basically it was a branding exercise. So like, yes, you know, like you would have Dinka commanders in a place like Northern Barakhazal, which is from like the center heartland of the Dinka, who would say, I've joined the IO, even which is the name of the opposition group under Machar, the In Opposition, SPLM In Opposition. Even though these commanders had nothing to do with Machar, nothing to do with the NUA, it was just a way for them to threaten Salva Kiir and push him into trying to get them reintegrated into the SPLM, just as was the case after the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005. So you have this sort of like fictional oppositional struggle between these two sides. Actually, what both Salva and Machar realize is the way they can run this war is by instrumentalizing ethnic and political differences across the country. And that's what they do. So you see increasingly across the country, these zero-sum contests between different groups. So what you have, and speaking very thematically, is you have a centralized authority under Salva Kiir, which is ruling by fragmenting ethnic relationships across the country. And this war continues, and ultimately we have to say that the IO, the SPLM In Opposition, they don't get a new name, they just get the name of they're in opposition and they're part of the SPLM. You know, right, like every, I mean, you'll see like there's a proliferation now of SPLMs. There's like SPLM IG in government, there's SPLM IO, there's SPLM IO IG, which is SPLM In Opposition in government, for the faction of the IO that has then been like turned and, you know, joined the government. There's real SPLM. There's like literally 19 different SPLM factions, because the reality is the project is still who controls the Revolutionary Party, as this end of it is. We can come back to that. By 2018, let's skip the first peace agreement, the IO is like utterly defeated. Why has it been utterly defeated? Couple of reasons. One is that Museveni and Uganda, which is a regional powerhouse, is entirely behind Salva Kiir. It has a lot of business interests in the country, which are guaranteed by Salva Kiir. Its army, the UPDF, the Ugandan Popular Defense Force, deployed to protect Juba at the very onset of the war, has thrown all its weight behind Salva. So normally the newer militias would go, great, Uganda's got, Salva's got Uganda, we're going to get Khartoum on our side, right? Remember that during the Second Civil War, of course, Khartoum always backed the newer militias. But this time there's been a sea change, which is that Salva has really modeled his regime on Bashir, the dictator who ruled Sudan for 20 years. He's got a massive security service. He's been ruling by divide and rule, by instrumentalizing militia groups, just like Bashir did. And he's then pushed out from the SPLM all of the Garangists, the people loyal to the legacy of John Garang to create a revolution in Khartoum. He's pushed them into opposition and he's replaced them with members of Bashir's party, the National Congress Party. So you have this insane situation where, having fought for 20 years, having achieved independence, being the youngest country in a place like Northern Barakazal, which is like the heartland of Salva Kiir's support, really, the governor, up until recently, was a member of the Bashir's party, was a member of the very force they've been fighting against for 20 years. Why did Salva do that? Well, because it guaranteed Sudanese support and denuded the IO of any Sudanese support. So the IO find themselves without any regional support, without any ammunition, without any guns, and they, to use a French phrase, they got their ass handed to them across the country. And they were pushed into this agreement in 2018 by Uganda and Sudan, which guaranteed the agreement, that was effectively a negotiated surrender. So Machar goes back into government, now as one of five vice presidents, because during the war, there'd been all of this fragmentation of the different opposition groups and government groups. The peace agreement lasts from 2018 to the present, if one would say that it still lasts. But I think we have to be clear about what the peace agreement is. The peace agreement is a means for Salva to continue to control the country. So everyone now is talking about, oh, no, there's a war in South Sudan. And the reason they're saying that is because diplomats fundamentally can't think outside the logic of Juba and whether Juba, the capital, is threatened. The reality is that violence this year is less than 2022, when you didn't hear anything about South Sudan. But all of that violence occurred in the periphery, because since the peace agreement was signed in 2018, Salva Kiir has been doing exactly the same thing across the country, except he's given war different names. So under the peace agreement, in theory, there's supposed to be a unified army composing the IO, the government, and all the different opposition groups. In reality, he hasn't created a unified army. He's been recruiting division-sized forces entirely outside the framework of the peace agreement. He's been buying off opposition commanders, and those defected commanders then go to war against their former colleagues. But Salva Kiir calls that intra-opposition fighting. And then the diplomatic corps gets to say, oh, it's not a war, it's these difficult opposition groups. Or alternatively, he sponsors ethnic militias, and they go to war in the international's favorite term, which is intercommunal violence. Intercommunal violence sounds like it's something that happens between ethnic groups, you know, in sort of like this time-tested way. It sort of rhymes with the rhythm of the seasons, the rainy season, the dry season. In reality, it's a way for Salva to split authority around the country. What he's done using the peace agreement is fragment authority, arrest customary authorities, and, you know, just decimate the possibility, not just of the opposition group, the Machar's group, but of opposition in general around the country. And what we've seen coming to the last couple of months is really just an intensification of that. So in December, Salva decides in his latest attack on the opposition that he wants control of checkpoints. Because since February, I know this is a lot of information, but since February in 2023, the oil pipeline, the main oil pipeline going to Sudan, has been offline. So they've had no money. So they've been trying to get money wherever they can. And in a country that basically has no productive industry, the way to get money is by controlling the means of circulation. So controlling checkpoints on the rivers, controlling checkpoints on the road, taxing, predating, getting what you can. And a war began last December for control of the remaining IO checkpoints in the west and the northeast of the country. And as part of that war, they were going to hit a place called Nasser. Now, Nasser is the heartland of the opposition. It's where where Machar declared his independence in the 1990s from Garang's party. And since 2014, it's been under a really violent government occupation. They've been shooting children. The commander there was so embattled that he couldn't even leave to go fishing. And given that the army gets no supplies, they really needed to go fishing. So they decided to mount a rescue mission to both relieve this commander and take control of Nasser from the opposition. And so the opposition, and we'll come to what the opposition is, handed the army's arse to it on a plate, this kicked them out of Nasser, declared their independence. That opposition was mainly communitarian youth groups, which are known as the White Army. They're known as the White Army partly because they wear ash to protect themselves against mosquitoes. They're not really connected to Mashar and to this opposition in Juba that has been totally integrated within the government. Nonetheless, Salva, the president, uses this as an excuse to arrest Mashar, arrest much of the opposition heartland in Juba, and declare basically a total counterinsurgency operation against the opposition. So it's been using attack helicopters, it's been dropping barrel bombs on civilians, it's been trying to destroy the remainder of whatever like meaningful popular opposition there is in the country. Meanwhile, Mashar is now in prison, and they have taken a different member of the SPLM-IO, Stephen Parkour, a very erudite, nice young man, and they've declared he's the new head of the opposition. The peace agreement is continuing. Nothing to see here. Don't worry about it. So we have this guy who has no political legitimacy, who's now the head of the IO. Mashar is stuck in prison, and the population is just being decimated. And that's sort of a short version of what's going on.
I think that's very comprehensive. It's really, there's a lot.
Yeah,
to
not that short. There. Good job, man. Yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah, we just let you go.
Yeah, that was a tour de force.
Freestyling.
So, I mean, let's unpack a couple of things. The 2018 peace deal that everybody seems to be hanging, or the international community is hanging itself on, or, you know, kind of sticking to and insisting that this is horrible, it's breaking down, we have to fix it. What you're describing sounds like a peace deal that was a fiction. It's a peace deal that addresses the fictional version of this conflict that people like Kiir and Mashar want to present as the, you know, what's happening, which is, you know, this elite on elite fighting for control of the state or control of the party, and the, you know, the resources that come with that. Whereas, you know, the conflict as it's being experienced by actual people in South Sudan is different from that. I mean, it's sort of, you know, manufactured by those elites to sustain their own conflict. But when you get to this 2018 peace deal, it's all about Kiir and Mashar. It's about Mashar is going to be the vice president. Kiir's here and we're going to have everybody get along. We're going to have Mashar's fighters incorporated into the army. We've got these camps or bases set up to sort of do re-education or some, you know, kind of synthesis of getting them into the army. But it sounds like something that's destined to fail because it's not real. It's a paper peace deal for the version of the conflict that's been kind of foisted out there by the elites. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think the peace deal is basically a negotiated surrender with a lot of baubles on it. And the problem with international community is they believe in the baubles. And the baubles are there's going to be elections, there's going to be a unified army. And I think no one in the peace deal seriously expects any of those things to happen. But that then becomes the discourse because it is a peace agreement that's written under the frameworks of liberal peace. And we are going to get democracy and happiness. But that's not the reality. The reality is it was always going to be basically a power sharing deal in which Salva tries to maneuver to push Mashar out of power.
One of the things that I've seen talked about in the last few months, I do want to get a little bit more into the White Army and what's been going on the ground. But one of the things I've seen talked about is this, which, you know, it comes for everybody. But Kiir is older. He's not maybe in the greatest health. There's discussion about succession and that somehow factoring into this new push to get Mashar into custody and kind of clamp down on things. What can you tell us about that and how big a factor has that been?
So in September, Salva extended the elections for the second time. And the elections were sort of clearly not going to happen. And the talk in Juba then became not about how to position ourselves for elections and who'd be part of the party, but who would succeed Salva. And Salva's always been very careful about not naming a successor. Because if you name a successor, then everyone else is someone to fight against. And one of the things that Salva does is consistently cycle through supposed chosen sons, who he puts up everywhere, and like they think, oh, this is Salva's guy, and then very abruptly Salva removes them. So from September through December, Salva basically changed literally everyone in government. He dismissed his main head of security, Akol Korkuç. He dismissed the head of the army, Santina Dengwall. Everybody changed. And part of the reason for those changes, one was to sort of coup-proof the regime, because some of the people had been planning a coup. The other thing was to prepare the ground for his finally nominated successor, which is Benjamin Baumel. And Benjamin Baumel just became, like, 2 days ago, literally, no, yesterday, the head, like, the deputy head of the SPLM. So it's really, this is what's happening. The problem is that Benjamin Baumel is an arriviste who arrived in, like, 2005. He's a businessman from Northern Marakhazar. He's in charge of Kiir's money. He's been in charge of diverting all the money from the pipelines into Kiir's pocket, but he has no popularity at all in the country. And he's really hated by the SPLM elite, for whom, in a country which is still very traditional in many ways, he's jumping the line. There are all of these like old SPLM figures, all of these old fighters who've been waiting for their chance to be president. And suddenly it's like, this guy from nowhere who never fought, who's been no part of the army, is going to get things. And that's been creating a great deal of unrest within the SPLM. And I think in terms of like the diplomatic sphere, for me, the real fear of a war in Juba is not about the opposition. This is just a continuation, a very violent continuation of what's been happening since 2018. The very real chance of a civil war that affects Juba will be when Salva Kiir, who is in poor health, passes over power to Baumel, and there's a split within the Dinka coalition undergirding Salva's regime. And that is the chance for a real civil war inside Juba.
So you mentioned the fighting in Upper Nile, Nasir, and the White Army, and the questionable connection between the White Army and Machar. Is there any overlap here between them, or is it entirely been manufactured by Kiir and the South Sudanese state to justify imprisoning Machar and kind of clearing him out of the way?
Oh, there's definitely an overlap. I mean, if you think about both the opposition and the army, they are in some sense weak military actors. So going back to the Second Civil War, all forces in Southern Sudan, they fight by mobilizing social currents on the ground. And the Dinka mobilize cattle guards, right? They're pastoralist people, and they fight by mobilizing the young men who protect cows. And the Nuer do the same thing. And during the war, as the conflict got greater and greater, they mobilized more and more young men. And when it came to the South Sudanese Civil War, they did the same thing. So Machar turned to the young Nuer men and was like, "You're being attacked by the army, come fight for me." And they did fight with the opposition military command. But they never fought with the opposition military command in the way the opposition military command wanted them to fight. Right? They're literally, for me, one of the only egalitarian forces on the ground today. Their leadership is chosen from among young men on the basis of their capacity, on the basis of their ability to fight and to win. And they do have a connection to Machar. But Machar doesn't make decisions about what they want to do. So repeatedly during the South Sudan Civil War, they would be told, like, go and fight in Juba. Go and attack the Dinka in their homeland. They're like, no, man, that's not what we do. We are a telluric force, right? Like, we protect our cattle. We protect our communities, right? And whenever I travel around South Sudan, I hear the same thing from all of these self-defense groups. We are the community defense. We are living under a state that attacks us and predates on us, and we are the forces that defend ourselves. And of course, that means sometimes they are instrumentalized by politicians, right? I don't want to create a narrative in which they're simply like heroic defenders of the community. It's a complicated situation in which they are also instrumentalized by politicians to attack other communities. But in the case of Nasser in particular, yes, Machar was communicating with them. No, that's not the reason they mobilized. No, that's not the reason they got ammunition. And no, that doesn't justify what Salva did. Because Salva didn't just arrest Machar. Salva arrested opposition commanders from Western Barakhazar, which is in the west of the country, as the name suggests, who are not even Nuer, right? Who are Fertit, who have nothing to do with the White Army, right? So, like, yes, there is a link. No, the link doesn't justify what happens on the ground in Juba.
And how much do we know about, you said overall the level of violence is actually down from what it was a couple of years ago, but we do hear reports and we get very scattered, you know, kind of snapshots of small bits of this in the U.S. But, you know, Doctors Without Borders a few days ago said the health system's breaking down across the country because of violence. We've heard about the violence in Upper Nile with the White Army. In Nasser, but what do we know about what's going on in other parts of the country? And is any of it sort of, can any of it be connected to this other, this you know, elite conflict or intra-elite conflict, or is it all really localized and just being kind of, you know, kind of lumped together by Western observers or by the elites in Juba?
So the checkpoint war was fought in Upper Nile, but also fought in the west of the country. And that was very much a bid by the Salva Kiir elite for economic control. And in both Upper Nile and in Western Equatoria, it fights not with the army, but it fights using ethnic militia commanders who have their own bones in the fight. Right. So in Western Equatoria, that fight has been against a group called the Balanda by the Zande, which stretch into Kaf. And in Western Barakazal, it's been against the Fertit. And those battles are battles that begin from decisions in Juba, even if they have local dynamics on the ground which exceed it. And I think that's even true of Warap, which is where Salva Kiir is from. All of those conflicts on the ground between communities are fundamentally conflicts which are about commanders in Juba vying for position by creating conflict in the peripheries.
At Byers Volkswagen, we've been family-owned since 1897, built on trust, driven by innovation. And now, buying your next Volkswagen is easier than ever. Shop online, customize your deal, and finalize everything from home. Just stop by to pick up the keys. It's that simple.
Right now, drive home a new 2025 Volkswagen Atlas for 2.9% APR for up to 60 months.
The next generation shops online, and we're driving with them at ColumbusVolkswagen.com or visit us by the airport.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 6/25.
Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. datemyage.com.
So how does this situation affect... has it been impacted by and is impacting the war in Sudan itself?
So since the beginning of the war, Salva Kiir has tried to walk this pretty delicate line. On the one hand, the two pipelines go north and they go to Port Sudan, which is the de facto administrative capital of the Sudanese army. They do not get oil out of the country without the Sudanese army acquiescence. So fundamentally, Salva needs to keep on side the Sudanese army. On the other hand, the rapid support forces, which are fighting a war against the Sudanese army, control most of the border with South Sudan. Not only that, but Salva Kiir's regime has a whole series of business interests with the rapid support forces. Not only that, but there's also rebel groups inside Sudan, now allied with the RSF, the SPLA, or Sudan People's Liberation Army, north, indicating that they are in northern Sudan, which have long historically been very close to Salva Kiir. So he tries to walk these forces together. How does he do that? Well, he has great business interests with the RSF. So the RSF send gold south from their mines in Darfur into South Sudan, from where they can go to Kampala in Uganda and then across to the UAE, to the United Arab Emirates, which is the RSF's main backer. So those business deals bind together Emirates, Uganda, South Sudan. They send fuel north from northern Barakazal to the RSF. Now they also will be sending in the future weapon supplies and food to new RSF bases in Upper Nile. On the other hand, SAF have also been moving troops and weapons through South Sudan into Sudan. So as much as he can, Salva says, I'm open to business with all of you guys. And like many of the different regional powers in that region, Ethiopia, Kenya, Chad, he's received money from the UAE to support the RSF. But none of those countries have come out in a simple way to support the RSF, right? So I think the problem with like something about the International Crisis Group is its imaginary is fundamentally based in the Cold War, that there are two coalitions, RSF coalition, army coalition. It's more complicated than that because what we have right now, and I try to write about this in a piece for Sidecar in the New Left Review and for about the Sudanese civil war, is you have a regional war economy in which most of the countries are playing both sides at the same time, because they're both fundamentally based in an extractive economy that wants to accumulate capital from this war rather than sort of choose one side to back against another. Everyone is profiting at the moment from the war inside Sudan.
Where does the IO, I mean, what does the IO, you know, do they have any connections with the Sudanese army? I mean, I know, you know, there've been some reports of kind of cross-border ish clashes in Upper Nile involving the RSF and the IO, or at least the, you know, forces that are lumped in with the IO in media coverage. But what sort of outside links does the IO have, if any, to, let's say, the Sudanese military or other actors?
So the IO would love more outside links. And if anyone is listening and has any weapons who would like the IO, I can connect you. They ask me all the time for weapons connections. They don't really have very many links. So if you can look at a map of Sudan and South Sudan, when the RSF joined in February of this year in an alliance with the SPLA North, and they control a place called Blue Nile, which is on the border with Upper Nile. And this worried SAF, the Sudanese army. And so the Sudanese army did ship some weapons to some IO commanders in a place called Mban. And it wanted those IO commanders to use those weapons to attack the RSF inside Blue Nile and basically to strafe and harass people in those bases. But the SAF, the Sudanese army, has been very clear it doesn't want weapons going to the White Army, because it doesn't know what the White Army will do, and is worried the White Army will attack the oil fields. And that's entirely possible. And so there have been some flows of weapons going to the IO, but not very many. And as we've seen in the last month, the White Army has been entirely scattered from most of its bases, most of its territories, because it has no ammunition. So it's deeply in search of ammunition. And, you know, I repeat the public message.
I want to talk about a couple of outside actors here. I mean, they're as you said, the whole region seems to be on, you know, open for business in terms of, especially the war in Sudan, but, you know, increasingly.
It's the American prestige of regions.
Yeah, exactly. they're open for business. But you know, bearing that in mind, and we can talk about, you know, this in the context of the war in Sudan as well as what's happening in South Sudan, it seems like the main actor here that's driving conflict and extracting what it can from those conflicts is the UAE. Am I wrong in saying that, and or is that the case? And what role, broadly speaking, is the UAE playing here?
So I'll reverse the question and address the UAE's role. The UAE has decided to go all in for Hemeti, who's the head of the RSF, because they think that Hemeti can guarantee them, one, an army. So in a sense, you have to think about the UAE as a sort of artificial leviathan that does not have enough men to constitute an army of its own, that does not have enough agricultural land to supply its population, that does not have enough gold to work really as the center of an extractive industry. And so it has acquired them from different places, right? It has agricultural land in Tanzania. It now has an army in Sudan. And let's not forget, it's already used the army, the RSF in Sudan, to fight a war in Yemen, right under its command. So it's been sort of expanding its territory in this non-territorial way, in a way that I think you can think about 21st century empire looking like today, right? And that's involved creating this regional compact, which involves buying off Chad, buying off Ethiopia, buying off Kenya, and knitting them into a framework really around like natural resource extraction, both agricultural land and the question of gold. But it's not true to say that they're the only main power in Sudan and in the conflict in Sudan. They're part of this war economy, right? I think one of the sort of the damaging things about Sudan is it's become a sort of crucible for the way wars can be fought. So it's a field of experimentation. One of the things that's being experimented with right now is how well can Turkish drones and Iranian air defense systems interact for the Sudan. So you have like, it's a huge drone war, right? But it's a drone war fought on both sides. You have Sudan being backed by Egypt, Iran, Turkey. But let's not forget, Sudan has also, until recently, had a very strong, the Sudanese army, strong relationship with the UAE itself, who controls one of their main gold mines and is the main source for most of it, most of their gold. The UAE has also had a shadowy role in backing some of the Islamist figures inside Sudan. right? And I think you see the same logic as in Libya, where you have like actually UAE deciding both sides of this can work, right? Like, yes, we have a loyalty to some degree to the RSF, but it's not, you know, unconditional. And we want to make sure we also have a foot on the other side, because what we need to do is, in a sense, create the right business environment. And as so often in capitalism, the right business environment is not, you know, like peace and happiness, but deep war and instability, because deep war and instability prove productive grounds for weak states and then capital extraction from natural resources.
To bring it back closer to South Sudan and the region, the other actor I want to talk about is Uganda. What role is Uganda playing here? You know, you've got Museveni, who is, you know, running for another, you know, going to be president again for another term. But his son, increasingly the commander of the Ugandan military, seems to be the public face of the Ugandan government, at least when it comes to making just wild pronouncements on social media. I mean, the guy is really out there, but, you know, he seems particularly intent on supporting Kiir. So what's their involvement been in this latest kind of, you know, at least, you know, the as far as the attention is concerned, this latest escalation? And what role does Uganda play more generally in this conflict or supporting Kiir?
Right. So Muhoozi, the son, is all in for Salva. And he, you know, he tweets, as you say, or X's, however you say it now, with a spirit and a vim and a vigor that, you know,
that exceeds
Trump. So Uganda, from the very beginning of this conflict, moved troops into the country to guarantee Juba. And it's done that a couple of times in the last couple of years whenever Salva leaves the country. And basically, Museveni wants to control this transitional process. As Salva leaves office, it wants to, like, one of the fundamental reasons it moved troops to the country was to say, like, whoever Salva decides as his successor, that is the person that we're backing. And he's been very, Muhoozi and Bolmel have a series of business deals. So the son of Museveni and Salva Kiir's chosen successor have a series of business deals. Museveni's brother has sugarcane plantations on South Sudanese territory in eastern Equatoria. They've pushed and displaced villages from opposition-held territory around the Equatorias. With the behest of the South Sudanese government, they've moved Ugandan forces into Western Barakazau to control some of the gold mines inside South Sudan to allow for weapon shipments from Uganda to the RSF. And, you know, people have complained and they've gone, this is a violation of South Sudanese sovereignty. But, well, maybe, but it's been done with the permission of the South Sudanese sovereign, which is to say that today Salva finds it much more useful and much more reliable to use the Ugandans than to use his own people, because political legitimacy has shrunk to that extent. And of course, they're paying the Ugandans. Unlike the National Army, which hasn't been paid in months, the Ugandans get paid for their role in this war. So the Ugandans have been using attack helicopters, they've been using transport helicopters for the South Sudanese military leadership, and they've been assisting in barrel bombing the civilians. And the reason for doing that is really to guarantee a situation in which Salva's uncontested reign of the country is indeed that, uncontested, and at the same time, that means that their business interests in the country are guaranteed.
What, if any, are some of the other regional considerations here? I mean, you've described the way that the regional countries are sort of acting on South Sudan. Are there considerations in terms of the conflict or you know, the breakdown of South Sudan, or what's happening in South Sudan, kind of spilling over? Like, does this make it more difficult to resolve the conflict in Sudan? Are there considerations for Ethiopia and some of the other countries in the region, as the situation goes on, or is it really contained to South Sudan?
I think there are some minor possibilities of spillover. I think the spillover narrative is massively overemphasized by the International Crisis Group, among others, and the main reason for that is that no one in the sort of foreign policy administration, the blob, as it's known, has any sort of like bandwidth or attention for the actual internal dynamics of a place like South Sudan. So the only way they can sell it is like regional cataclysm. There's going to be a regional civil war, right? But the reality is so in Central African Republic, there's a force of Zande who were trained by Wagner, or what, you know, the new Wagner, that are now fighting inside South Sudan. And there's a conflict between the UPC, theory now like joined with the government, but not really, and Zande militias, which like spreads between DRC, GAR, and South Sudan. There's been some cases of South Sudanese fighting in the Sudanese civil war, sure. But, you know, like those guys fighting are not really part of South Sudanese rebel groups. They're young South Sudanese men inside Sudan who are poor and impoverished and in need of a gun and some money, just like everyone else who's fighting inside Sudan, right? It's not really a joining. Like the thing is that South Sudan's conflict is very violent internally to South Sudan, but they're not major military players. Ethiopia, right? Like if you look at the conflict inside Sudan and the role played by the UAE, and Egypt and Iran, it's so massively more and massively more important than anything South Sudan can do, right? It's just like, it sort of overstates anything to talk about spillover. And I think the same in Ethiopia, like the relationship with Eritrea, the question of Tigray, even the question of Sudan, they're all so much more important than like, yes, there are like South Sudanese rebels in Gambela, which is a newer part of Ethiopia on the border with Upper Nile. Yes, they have been mobilizing there. Is that a major threat to Ethiopian stability or to the like politics in Ethiopia? Not really. Like it's a side story, right? And so I'm anti-regional spillover, but that's just also, I think, as a fun, like if it wasn't for the fact that that's the only way anyone's trying to like sell South Sudan, then I'd probably be like, yes, there are cases of regional spillover, but I think that in this context, it's important to say like South Sudan's wars, though they've always relied on regional backers, have never really resulted in regional spillover. And that's as true now as it was in the 1980s.
You mentioned Wagner, and I always dread asking this question about conflicts like this because it's like, how can I make this about us? How can I make this about us? But what is the, you know, what are the sort of major powers involvement here or interest? You know, you talk about Russia, you talk about China, the U.S. There is oil in South Sudan. Obviously, that drives some international interest. But talk a little bit about that dynamic and whether there's any impetus, I guess, for any of these powers to kind of step in and try to put a stop to things or to foster it, you know, is the alternative.
So, I mean, the American role was that they were the biggest supporters of Salva's government for many, many years, right? And they were, up until the recent foreign aid cuts, 70% of the humanitarian budget in South Sudan. And that's gone. They've also withdrawn in an act of like deep spite their 9 peacekeepers from the UN peacekeeping mission inside South Sudan. America, like in many places in Africa, is entirely withdrawing, right? And the consequences in terms of the humanitarian situation are absolutely dire. This is a country in which more than 2/3 of the country needs humanitarian assistance. But the basic position is that they've thrown their toys out with the pram. Right? They're just like, they didn't do what we wanted to do, and yet we gave them everything. We gave them the ammunition for a state, right? Like, South Sudan is, for me, the poster child of the failure of a liberal state-building fantasy that emerges from the 1990s, right? They gave so much money to Salva and to the SPLM, and rather than build a liberal state, he built a predatory, centralized dictatorship. And I don't, like, blame Salva for that. Like, this is the state the Americans made. They looked at it, they didn't like it, and because there's not really any regional interest in South Sudan, they just have withdrawn. And like they make, you know, they mouth like, we want the peace agreement implemented, but everyone knows the peace agreement won't be implemented and they have no strategic vision for what South Sudan should actually look like. China's always remained very guarded and on the back foot. It does have an interest in the oil that comes out of South Sudan. But we also have to say the amount of oil that comes out of South Sudan is pretty minimal. That was even before the pipeline turn off in February 2023. It's very viscous oil. Like, it's very thick. It only has a few uses, right? It's not like we're talking about Angola, right? Where, like, China's role in maintaining the petrostate is very, very clear. It's a very minimal relationship. The oil companies have historically been Malaysian, Indian, and Chinese, assisting a parastatal company like the Nalpet. They all have a role in the oil continuing to flow, and that has, like, basically predicated everyone on the continuance of Salva's regime. Right, like I think there is a basic position that just says, like, we don't know what the White Army is, we don't know what the opposition is. Let's just keep going with the situation as we know. Russia's like variously tried to get involved. I mean, via Wagner in South Sudan, and you know, just hasn't. Basically, because there's just no real need for them. right? Because instead of like having that, like outsourcing violent conflict to Wagner, you outsource violent conflict to ethnic militias, and that's been the way that it's run. I mean, and then the only sort of last thing is that the recently Fogbo, who you might remember from the Pier disaster in Gaza, the U.S. private military contractor, is now running aid operations.
The Joe Biden Memorial Pier for everybody.
The Joe Biden Memorial Pier.
Rest in peace.
Yeah. So one of the organizations that use that, which is run by former CIA guys, is now doing the food aid for the government inside South Sudan. So there is some, you know, a PMC, though, of course, they're not PMC, they're humanitarian logistics, as brought to you by the CIA. But they are doing humanitarian aid inside South Sudan as of, you know, yesterday or something.
So, I mean, my wrap-up question here is going to be, is it too late to salvage the peace deal? But I don't think there's anything to salvage, or maybe there never was anything to salvage in the 2018 peace deal. So instead, without, you know, trying to divine the future or anything like that, where do you think things are heading in the near term? Is this, you mentioned the possibility of an intra-Dinka civil war, basically, when Kiir passes or tries to hand power off, whatever comes first. Is that locked in? Are we basically locked into that? Is that something that maybe even needs to happen to kind of resolve some of the tensions in the country? Like, what are some of the potential outcomes here that people should be aware of?
I mean, I think it's hard to overstate just how bad the humanitarian situation in the country is, right? Like, there will be areas of famine declared in the new IPC, which is the framework that analyzes, you know, food insecurity around the globe. The country is incredibly fragmented. It's very unlikely to be able to put it back together again. The Dinka civil war that is likely to happen will not lead to, I think, a unified government. I don't think, like, you know, I think like there's a danger to sort of think of it as like bad bloodletting, and then like there'll be unity. Like, the reality is that the next civil war will be even more fragmented, and it will result in a gradually narrowing political compact in Juba and more separation around the country, right? I think, like, if you look at what's happened since 2011 in independence, the country is poorer, it is more violent, it is more fragmented, and I think the centrifugal forces creating those processes are really regional and global, and they're not going to be put back together by some sort of minor peace deal which is focused on Juba, which is all the international community has an appetite for.
On that happy note, as we like to end this show, always on a happy note, Joshua, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us about this. Where can people find your work?
They can find it on my very imaginatively named website, www.joshuacraze.com.
All right. We will link to that in the show description. I'm sure I'll have occasion to have you back as these conflicts continue. But thanks for doing this.
Pleasure. Nice to see you both.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
In state and local government, tech upgrades aren't optional. They're essential. Whether it's improving digital services, protecting public data, or modernizing outdated systems, the demand for skilled IT professionals has never been higher. CBT Nuggets helps you stay ahead with affordable, on-demand IT training that's built for your schedule. Our short, practical videos and hands-on virtual labs make it easy to build real-world skills in networking, cybersecurity, cloud technologies, and more. You don't need expensive hardware or complicated setups, just a browser and the motivation to grow. Whether you're an IT admin, public service tech, or new to the field, CBT Nuggets gives you the tools to better support your team and your community. And with new content added regularly, there's always something relevant to learn. Join thousands of learners who are upgrading their skills and advancing their careers. Start your 7-day free trial today at cbtnuggets.com. Because smarter tech skills don't just help you, they help your whole community succeed.